Welcome to podcast number 6 of an 8-part podcast series on international arbitration featuring Bob Davidson, the head of the international arbitration practice at JAMS. This podcast number 6 is on the hearing and award.
Okay, as far as the hearing goes, and I think we're going to talk mainly about the hearing in this particular podcast, and then we're going to talk about the award in podcast 7. But the hearing is also, of course, very important. You've now gone through all your preliminary stages. Procedural order number 1 has been complied with. You have dealt with any applications. You have set, hopefully, you have set rules for the hearing. And now you're here. Everyone's in a conference room. First, who's going to attend? Well, you may have an application to sequester fact witnesses, and sometimes you'll get an application to sequester experts as well. The usual result of that, although it's discretionary with the tribunal, is to sequester witnesses until they have testified, but allow experts to attend the full hearing or parts of it if they wish. Often a party representative will be designated by one of the parties, and that'll be a key witness. And the other side will complain that the other side has cleverly designated a key witness as his party representative, and that party representative will be hearing the testimony of everyone else before he or she testifies. Well, the answer to that is that the rules permit any party to be represented, or to be any side to have a party representative of its choice at its side. And therefore, you have really, you don't have much authority to say that the potential witness shall not be a party representative. But usually, if you make a statement to the effect that, look, I know Mr. Jones has a lot to say about this, and he's going to hear Mr. Smith testify before he does, I can't stop Mr. Jones from being designated a party rep, but I want everyone to know that I will know he's in the room when he's testifying, and that he has heard Mr. Smith, and I will consider that when I'm dealing with weight and credibility. And if you say it like that, the other side will often excuse Mr. Jones and say, well, why don't I use Mr. Brown, and Jones will show up after he's testified. But if he doesn't, he doesn't, and that's what you said. We've gone through in previous podcasts confidentiality and privacy. You will hopefully have a stipulation of some sort which will deal with that. If not, the institutional rules under which you operate will say something about that. With respect to attendance, any witness who has submitted a written witness statement must attend and be subject to cross-examination. That should be a pretty inviolate rule of yours, even if the other side doesn't like cross-examination. And if that witness declines to attend, the witness statement will not be taken into account. It is not great practice in an international proceeding to say, well, the witness didn't show up, so I'll let the witness statement stand for what it's worth. Much better that you take the witness statement and say it is no longer in evidence and hand it back to the other side, and the tribunal will not consider it in connection with the evidence that it will look at. This is important because you have to give every side not only the impression but the truthful impression that you are holding these rules equally to both sides. The UNCITRAL model law in Article 18 says something like, it is the obligation of the tribunal to treat the parties with equality. Not equally, but with equality. And that is a very important concept, not just for the integrity of the award, but for the feelings of all the parties around the table that they've gotten a fair share. There's nothing worse than promulgating a procedural rule and then failing to enforce it. Now, at the hearings, you will often have opening statements. You will have previously, hopefully, determined whether or not demonstratives are going to be used by counsel. These cases often are done with a whole raft of bound demonstrative exhibits with screens and in front of the arbitrators and a big screen in the room generally. And the counsel will stand there, and for the first 2 hours, he will go through the entire case, tell you what he thinks the witness statements show and what he intends to prove, and the other side will do the same. You will have a rule about whether or not those demonstratives are going to be cleared beforehand, or whether or not the lawyers agree that each of them can use the demonstratives without clearing them, at least for opening statements. And then you will take the evidence. And the evidence goes in the order of the same burden of proof. The party who has the burden of proving the proposition will go first. And if they're written witness statements, you know, call your first witness, and that witness will show up and be subject to cross-examination based on the witness statement that he or she has submitted. It's gotten to be popular now for lawyers, mostly from the U.S., to demand that witnesses be called in their case as adverse witnesses. And they do that almost as an element of surprise, or to put people off their guard, or create a problem with respect to the flow of the presentation of evidence for the other side. It's almost always tactical. And sometimes you will have lawyers from one side demand the appearance of witnesses for whom the other side has not submitted a written witness statement. Suppose the other side has submitted simply witness statements from a purchasing agent, from one of the people who attended the negotiations, and from the inspector of the goods, but has not even put in a witness statement of the chief executive who purportedly had serious and important conversations with the other side. And that'll be done tactically. And then the other side, prior to the hearing, will demand the appearance of that person, even though that person did not put in a written witness statement. And when those things happen, you will get a battle royal. And you're going to have to decide it. There is no rule that says you can't decide it the way you think it should fairly be decided. Your obligation, again, which is recited in the Unser Trial Model Law, which might not be applicable precisely, but is still the touchstone of what has to be done, is to treat the parties with equality and to give them a fair hearing. And if you think that a witness who was not did not submit a written witness statement really ought to say something or show up, I mean, you'll have to, if you have three arbitrators, you consult. If not, you'll have to decide whether or not you order that witness to appear or make a statement to the effect that, look, I know the president of the company has not been submitted a witness statement, so I'm not going to force him to appear. However, I want the party to know that I will take that into account, and if there is evidence that could have been presented by your side and wasn't under your control, I reserve the right to draw an adverse inference. And that puts the burden on the lawyers to make a tactical decision. In any event, this is all discretionary, but you may have to make it. Experts. The experts will testify, and often expert testimony is critical, especially in these technical cases. There is also a hint in managing expert testimony. Very rarely in domestic cases, but it's gotten very common in international cases to do what's called hot tubbing. In other words, there are two witnesses and they both have the same topic, let's say tensile strength of a material, if I can use that same example. You get both witnesses who may be real experts, and you swear them both, and you either sit them on a table in front of you, side by side, or you have them sit in the side of the table, wherever you want them to, separate them physically. But you begin, one side starts asking the adverse witness questions in the nature of cross, and the tribunal will invariably take over the questioning. And they'll say, look, Mr. Jones, you say that this metal was strong enough because the test that was used was not sanctioned by this standards body. Is that correct? Yes. And then you can turn, you can say, okay, pause for a minute, and you can go to the other expert, and you can point to that expert and say, what do you say about that? And you can wind up with very interesting testimony. It's got to be popular. It has to be done with care, and it can only be done with experts on the same or very similar topics. But it is an option that you have as an arbitrator to hot tub experts. If not, you can do it in the traditional way, testifying. You can also deal with the order of testimony. Suppose you got six experts, maybe on three different topics, discrete topics. Maybe you want the two who testify on tensile strength to testify right after each other, so you don't forget, or you can integrate this information better. Maybe you want the damages experts at the end to testify, one for one side, one for the other, rather than have all three experts on the claimant's side testify and then do all three respondents' experts. These are things that you can deal with, and you should deal with as a preliminary matter in a conference call prior to the hearing, and if necessary, you can talk about it at the hearing itself. Documentary evidence. You will hear some nomenclature here again. Something called a core bundle. A core bundle, which really came out of the Asian practices, is the sum total or population of all of the documents that have been offered by one side or the other, or going to be offered or potentially offered into evidence. They'll show up in binders in back of you, and you can deal with it and then have them shipped home and read them at your leisure after the hearing is concluded. It's evolved to also mean a core bundle of documents as being the five or six critical documents in the case, which could be the contract, it could be the notice of termination, it could be an interim court decision, whatever it is. They would bind that core document bundle in a smaller bound volume, which you can keep and make notes on. And I like paper, so I'm always using a yellow highlight. Some arbitrators use different colors for different things. But you don't have to keep on maneuvering big, heavy books in back of you to find the same document again and again. And you can tell the lawyers to agree on what core documents would be in the bundle and assure them that the presence or absence of a document in a bundle does not imply anything, except it's going to be easier to maneuver the books at the arbitration. You have objections to exhibits that might come in if you're dealing with common law lawyers. You know, sometimes it gets very obnoxious. You will have, you know, objection hearsay constantly, even though there's no hearsay and the rules of evidence don't apply in these proceedings. Nothing wrong with your reminding one of the lawyers that you're not in a courtroom. The rules of evidence don't apply. You know hearsay when you hear it. It will go into credibility and weight, but all the testimony is coming in. And let me just offer some advice. It is better to permit broad questioning, or questioning that you would not allow, let's say, at a judicial proceeding, you know, why did you bring this case, that kind of thing. And let people sometimes make short speeches that they would not otherwise be able to make in a courtroom. Very important in an international proceeding, especially when parties hail from different parts of the world, that they walk out of the room. They may win or lose, but they walk out of the room that they have not been restricted in the way they've been able to submit their cases. One thing about demonstrative exhibits, there should be an order around, hopefully before the proceeding began, in which the parties agreed to exchange demonstratives that the experts or others are going to use at least maybe 24 hours, maybe 48 hours before their use. These demonstratives can be significant problems at a hearing when a demonstrative is flashed up on the screen and one side has a real problem with it because embedded within it is either incorrect information, or information that shouldn't be on it. So it's good to deal with that particular problem. I have run into situations that almost got out of hand with respect to demonstrative exhibits. Privilege issues. Privilege is something you're going to have to be very sensitive to. Arbitrators take evidence, and all the rules of these institutions just about provide that the arbitrators shall enforce rules of privilege. Now, attorney-client privilege is fairly easy, except, you know, in Europe, if you're in-house counsel and you meet and give legal advice to your executives, that generally is not privileged. And in civil courts, the report that you gave to management, the conversations that you had with the alleged offenders, et cetera, are all discoverable in the sense that people can testify about them. In the United States, the rule is generally opposite, that in-house counsel does have that privilege. So I point this out to indicate that there are different privilege rules. We have, for example, a work product privilege, which other systems don't have. You have to determine what rules of privilege apply, and the usual suggestion is to apply the strictest ones that might arguably apply. I'm not a big fan of that rule. I think it's governed by the substantive law chosen by the parties. Although there is a significant issue, suppose you're sitting in France on a contract in which the substantive laws of the state of New York apply, and you've got one of these in-house counsel situations, and someone's arguing it's not privileged, and the other one's arguing it is. You know, maybe some briefing is in order, and maybe you have to talk about whether or not a particular testimony is going to be brought in. But be aware of privilege issues. They differ in jurisdictions. Time management is the last thing I want to talk about. I find a chess clock approach to be pretty good. There may be occasions, good reasons why one side needs more time than the other, but I think you should set the rule, and whatever the rule is, you should enforce it. I find that in these proceedings, you get maybe, and this is even without the need to translate testimony, is you get about 5 3/4, maybe 6 hours of testimony a day. So if you have a 5-day hearing, 5 × 6 = 30. If you divide by 2, it's 15 hours for each side. And at the very beginning, you tell each side you got 15 hours each. You'll be charged with the time used in your openings or closings, the time used in your direct examinations, and the time used in crossing the other side's witnesses. Any tribunal questions will go against the lawyer who's at bat at the time. And that's the way we're going to do it. And at the end of the day, tally up how much time has been used by both sides. I usually appoint a paralegal on both sides of the table to please independently keep it and then confer at the end of the day and reach agreement, and they do. And at the end of the day, we have this, it's almost funny, we all have this announcement, and we bicker over 5 minutes here or 3 minutes there, and we come to a conclusion about how much was used and how much is left. And if you do that, when you get to the end of the fifth day, the case will end, right? I have had occasion where one lawyer, and it was an international case, he was running out of time. He had, I think, a half hour left, and he was cross-examining in a very kind of innocuous, ineffective way, a witness, and the president of the company was going to show up the next day, critical witness. And I said to him, I stopped, and I said, listen, I'm not telling you how to run your case. You can try the case any way that you would like. However, I got to tell you, the president of the company is coming tomorrow. You have 31 minutes left, and you might want to save some time to cross-examine him, because after 31 minutes, the gate is going to slam shut. I said that, and he went, all right, I think I'll stop cross-examining this other guy. And so that accomplished two things. One, it allowed him time, so he can't complain. He was treated unfairly when he's got no time left and no one told him that, and he thought, well, of course I'm going to let it in. And the other thing it communicated was that I'm not kidding when I make an order. That's the way it's going to be set. So that's just a little story to tell you how I think you ought to run these proceedings.